Okay, everybody, good morning. I hope you had a wonderful Yantif. I want to get started because, first of all, it's time, and second of all, because I have to run right after the shiur. So I want to make sure we can end as close to on time as possible. Thanks, as always, to Sue and Frank for hosting us. And as always, of course, the shiur is in memory of Chaim Gittel, but today's shiur in particular is in memory of Sue's mother, Zissel Bat Ariel HaKohen. Azriel, that typo was not for me. I'll leave you to discuss that with your husband. I'm reading what he wrote. Anyway, but Azriel, the Yortzeit is today?
No, it was the 24th of
Nisan. Was the 24th of Nisan? Okay, last week. But okay, so our first opportunity to learn together since then. So we thank you very, very much. And Neshama Shav and Aliyah. And we appreciate the hospitality. That's a schus for him and for her. And also the Torah that we will learn. So thank you so much as always. Okay. Of course, this past week was the commemoration of Yom HaShoah, and maybe one year we'll give a shiur about the controversy of Yom HaShoah. Should there be a day called Yom HaShoah or not? But that's not at all our topic today. I just thought it's an opportunity to discuss something that I don't know if I've ever discussed in this context, and we don't probably discuss in general enough, and that is some of the religious challenges and some of the issues of Emunah and faith that arise from the horrors of the Holocaust. And it should be obvious, but I will state it nonetheless, that a topic like this is so huge and so big, it could be many, 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 many books, and certainly many, many, many shurim. So to say that in the next 55 minutes, we're going to cover everything would obviously be absurd. So the real challenge for me wasn't deciding on what to talk about, but was deciding on what not to talk about. I started off with a list this big of things I wanted to tell you, and obviously I had to, you know, edit myself, which I thought one of the more insightful comments made to me many, many years ago by one of the great teachers and speakers of the last generation, Rabbi Norman Lamb, Zechron Levracha. He once told me that for a rabbi, who takes his craft seriously, to edit himself is like doing surgery on yourself without the anesthesia. Very, very hard. Very, very painful. But nevertheless, I tried to reduce it to, I don't know, I want to say the main, but at least what was on my mind, some of the main ideas and principles that hopefully we can focus on. But again, with the caveat that obviously this is just a tipa shebayam, od chazon lemoed. Obviously, we're only just giving a little bit of a reference to some of the issues, and even the issues that we're discussing, we're not going to do comprehensively. It's not possible. And there's so many other things that we could discuss that we're not going to discuss. So with all of that, now that we've got all the apologies out of the way, what do I want to talk about? So the first point I'd like to make, as I think we have to be more honest than people in the Frum community often are. That is to say, there's an instinct in the Frum community. It perhaps comes from a good place, but it's actually a unhealthy thing. And it's actually just wrong, aside from being unhealthy. In some ways, there's an instinct to minimalize, or at least to use a term that's very popular nowadays, to contextualize the events of the Holocaust. Just like the friends of Eov, when they come to comfort him, try to give all sorts of explanations for his great suffering, which end up being not only cruel, but religiously problematic. But why are they doing it? They're not trying to be cruel, but they're threatened, right? If we would be honest and open our eyes to the actual horrors, what would that say about our belief? What would that say about Judaism? What does that say about our belief in God? I mean, it's so overwhelming. It's almost easier to avoid or contextualize or give some kind of a teretz. And that's what Eov's friends try to do. But if you're familiar with the Sefer Eov, they're roundly criticized. So I think on some level, people, even on an individual level, and sometimes even leaders or rabbis, you don't get so much, I would say minimalizing that, probably not so much, but the contextualizing, it's not the only bad thing that ever happened to the Jews, and just like the Jews had Emunah even in the Holocaust, in the Crusades, and in the Spanish expulsion, and the Chmelnytsky massacre, and all these other things, so, this is just another thing, and if our Bubbas and our Zetas could fight through the challenges of those things, so I think, it comes from, to some extent, it comes from a good place, but it's terribly mistaken. It's terribly, terribly mistaken. Because the reality is that there was absolutely nothing ever in the history of the Jewish people that comes close to the Holocaust. And to deny that is either to deny history, deny reality. It's actually just foolish. And it's dishonest. Now that's not me speaking. I'm going to give you just, I could give you more, I'm going to give you just three samples from great Gedolim of the previous generations, including two who went through the Holocaust, one who survived and one who did not. So take a look at source number one. This is none other than the famous Eish Kodesh, the Piasetzner Rebbe. Piasetzner was a little shtetl outside of Warsaw. He was gathered into the Warsaw ghetto for a number of years before the liquidation of the ghetto. And he famously gave drushas to inspire and to encourage the people of the ghetto. The scraps of his notes were saved. It's a whole story, miraculously, how after the war they were discovered, sent off to his surviving brother in Israel, whose grandson, I believe it is, son or grandson, is the one of the Eish Kodesh here in our neighborhood on Maor, that shul. And we have these drushas, which eventually were given the title Eish Kodesh. So if you take a look at the source number one, this is from the eighth day of Hanukkah, 1941. So this is something that was being said in the ghetto to the people struggling in the ghetto. So says the Eish Kodesh, initially, he starts off very strongly, actually, more strongly than I can even imagine, from that, what I'm calling mistaken, but from that perspective that I was starting with. He says, "Hein emes sheyisurin kmo elu she'anu sovelin ata ba'os rak achas l'kamas me'o shanim." So even then, in his first impression, he says, listen, no one's saying that what we're dealing with in the ghetto is typical. It's the kind of thing that happens in Jewish history maybe once every few hundred years. It's not typical. And yet, even though he's admitting it's bad, it's once every 100 years. Lamazen nifkam ish kazem yisurim elu ke'et yosir mikola yisurim sh'avro yisrael mayas. Okay, but every few hundred years, the Jewish people suffer something horrible. This is the patterns of Jewish history. And just like in previous centuries, Jewish people were able to march through, soldier on. So why should what we're going through be any different? After all, look at Psukim, look at the Gemara, look at the Medrash, and you'll see so many tzaros the Jewish people had before our generation, and that didn't affect their emunah, that didn't affect their faith. Why should all of a sudden now we be affected? Kol elu ha'anashim she'omrim she'yisurim kamo elu od lo hali Yisrael, toim eim. Anyone who thinks that the Holocaust is unique, they're mistaken, he says. This is the same as everything else. B'chorban Beis HaMikdash, in the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, afterwards in the fall of Beitar, and many other examples, Hayu kamo elu. It's again, he's not saying it's nothing. Hashem Yerachem, Hashem should tell our tzaros enough. Please help us, God. But this is, you know, it's not every day, but every few hundred years we have something really, really horrible. And just like other generations have soldiered through, why shouldn't we? If I would say something like this, you'd sound, it sounds very cruel. But he was going through it. When you're going through it, you know, you have this dibur. But that was his perspective in 1941. But they published, it's in the Sefer, on the bottom of that page, a footnote. There's a star. And you look at the bottom, there's a footnote. And they add that while that was in December 1941, the next year, Hanukkah 1942, he wrote as follows. He changed his mind. He realized he was wrong. That was what was happening until then. Aval now, he says, Hatzaros Mashunos. Now I realize this is actually not part of a pattern of Jewish history. Misos Ros Umashunos, Shechidshu HaRashayim HaRotzchim HaMashunim Aleinu Beis Yisrael, Mishilhi Toshet. Something in his mind, I'll give you two theories of what might have changed in a minute, but something in his mind changed going from 1941 to 1942. Ulefi Yediasi B'Divrei Chazal, he says, and I now can say, based on my knowledge of Jewish history, my knowledge of Jewish sources, lo haya kamosa. There's never, ever been anything in history like what we're going through. Hashem yirachem aleinu v'yatzilenu miyadam kerifayin. It gives you the date, exactly when he said this. Yudches Kislev, etc. So, first of all, you have an eyewitness who came from that more traditional perspective, that instinct to contextualize what they were going through. Yes, it's bad, but Jews have never had it easy. And sometimes we have it even worse than easy, and it happened before, and it'll happen again, and this is now it's our turn to pay the price of Jewish history. That was his first instinct. We can understand where it's coming from. But then he realizes he made a mistake, and he had the courage and the honesty to admit his mistake. He said, what's going on now in the Holocaust is unprecedented. There's a professor in New York named Dr. Henry Abramson. I believe he's now at Touro College. I think he's a dean there, a Jewish historian. So he has a book where he provides historical background, and sometimes it's, you know, he has concrete facts, and sometimes it's his theories, to explain the historical context of the different drushos in the Sefer Esh Kodesh. Sometimes he writes about what's going on, like I gave you an example a little bit now, or he hints at what's going on. But other times you just see him talking, and he did a lot of historical research to try to explain, well, what might have led the Esh Kodesh to say this or that. So, for example, it could be a certain drusha, and all of a sudden he's very pain, and then Dr. Abramson will tell you, yes, because actually we know that his wife died that week, or something like that. And he fills in certain historical blanks. It's a very interesting story, a book which I have at home. So he theorizes that it could be one of two things that took place that changed in between those two drushas. Number one is we know that there were, I don't know if it was one or two people, but a very small number, maybe it was only one, I don't remember exactly, there was somebody who escaped from Chelmo. You remember at the time there was all these rumors, right? Because of course the Nazis said there's just work camps and etc. Are they really killing? You know, so people would hear some rumors, but you know, it wasn't just the Americans or other people who couldn't believe it, right? The people themselves couldn't believe it. There was obvious reasons to be in denial. And then there was at least one, but I can't remember, maybe there's more, this is easily, you can easily look this up. Very famous people, they escaped from Chelmo. And they had testimony which they wanted to get not only to the Jewish world, but to the Americans and others, the British, the Allies. No, they're really killing us. They're gassing us. These are death camps. So that happened in between these two drushes. So it could be that awareness was like, whoa, that never happened in history before. Number two, he suggests also, that in between those two, that's when the liquidation of the ghetto had started. It culminated, the final liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto is basically Tisha B'Av 1942, a few months after this is written. But it started, I don't remember the exact date, again, it's easy to look it up, but it started in between the Hanukkah of 1941 and when he changes. So all of a sudden now he sees what's going on. Something changed. He alludes to it. He says something changed. We just don't know what he was talking about. Something changed, and now he says, I admit I was wrong. The Holocaust is unprecedented. Take a look at source number two. We have a Litvisha perspective, also from an eyewitness, who survived. And this is one of the great non-Hasid Gedolim of that generation, Chili Yaakov Weinberg, otherwise known as the Sridi Eish. He was a great, great Gedol in Germany, one of the great Yekesha Gedolim, but he was really one of the great Gedolim of it all. He was, you know, even though most of the people in the Warsaw Ghetto were not Yekesh at all, but he was so respected, he was considered part of the Gedolim of the Warsaw, whatever, they had some kind of a Moetzes or something that was helping run the community in the ghetto. He was part of it. He ends up surviving, but eventually goes to Montreux, Switzerland, where he lives the rest of his life. I think, if I remember correctly, he died in the 1970s, if I'm not mistaken. But he was never the same after the Holocaust. He was a great Gadol, people corresponded with him, but people wanted him to come to Israel, he could have been the chief rabbi, all sorts of things. And he basically says he can't. He doesn't go to America, he doesn't go to Israel. He stays in a very small little shtetl in Switzerland the rest of his life. That's one of the, but he was a great, great posek. We study his works in Shurim all the time here. The Sri Yesh, very, very important posek. So he has a book of Hashkafa, which is a collection of his essays called Lifrakim. And there he talks about the Warsaw Ghetto itself, the same ghetto that the Esh Kodesh was talking about. And he says also here, if you take a look, source number two, Rotza ani lahagid ki asfarim, that probably should say medabrim, I guess, shenichtavu al hamorot ha'eyomim begetto. He says there's all these books. I forget what year this essay was written, but it's obviously it wasn't written contemporaneously. This is something that was written after the Holocaust. He says all the books, all the historical accounts about what happened in the ghetto, lo matzino af mixas shema mixas, v'kamash iro shema mitzius. He says the books don't even give you a fraction. As bad as the stories are that you've read, the historical accounts, they're just telling you a fraction of a fraction of how bad it was. Because you can't imagine what was revealed, the beast animal-like cruelty of the Nazis and the Germans. What they did to us, ma'asei achzariyut, ta'alu cherpak otam shel knufia tamaratzchim begedo ha'varshi'i, lo ra'u shamayim v'aretz miyom hibaram. Says nothing like this has ever been seen in the history of the world since the 6 days of creation. In the history of the world, nothing has ever happened. This instinct, you might have heard a high school Rebbe or a seminary teacher tell you, it's like, the Churban was also terrible. It was. But says the Sri Yesh, it didn't compare it to the Holocaust. The Holocaust was much worse. In all of human history, nothing's ever happened like this, says the Sri Yesh. And now look what he says here, unbelievably, the last three lines. Savruni, he goes, at the moment, when I was going through the suffering of the Warsaw Ghetto, I thought to myself, Ki tovim hayu kronos hamavis, shehovilu gvarim noshim v'taf, excuse me, I have a cold. Mikol afse Europa el machnos hashmada. I thought it would probably be better to be on the death trains that were bringing men, women, and children from all of Europe to the concentration camps. And it would even be better to be in the Tihah Gaz. It would even be better to be in the gas chambers. Or in Kifshuni Ha'esh, the crematoria. Asher Abaham Nisrafu Chayim Milyoni Nefeshos Yehudim. Those places where millions of Jews lost their lives. The trains, the camps, the crematoria. Even any of those would be better. That's how bad the Warsaw Ghetto was, he says. At any moment, I would have preferred to be in a crematoria or a gas chamber than to be in the Warsaw Ghetto. Unprecedented horror. Last but not least, take a look at source number three. Someone who was able to avoid all of this, but a contemporary in terms of his age, and that was Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe says something similar, source number three. He says, people sometimes want to say, listen, we have a theology, we have a hashkafa, we have a emuna, if nechata enu, galinu miyartzenu, v'hayim shamoa. In other words, bad things happen because we sin, we're not perfect. So when we do a little sin, we expect a little potch. We got a really, really big potch, it must be that we did something really, really bad. And there's a certain instinct to assume that the Holocaust was a punishment. So if you ask the Zionists, they'll tell you it's because of the anti-Zionists. If you ask the anti-Zionists, they'll tell you it's because of the Zionists. Yekkes will tell you it's because of the Hungarians. Hungarians will tell you because of the Yekkes, etc., right? Rabbi Lamb made this observation many, many years ago in a very important essay that it says, Mipnei chate'enu. Even if you want to look at sin as the cause of suffering, you're supposed to look at your own sin. But when it comes to the Holocaust, everyone looks at everyone else's sin. Mipnei chate'ehem. That's not what we say in Musaf. We say Mipnei chate'enu. So even if we were going to look to say the Holocaust is a punishment, he says the problem is everyone's looking to blame somebody else instead of take responsibility themselves. But leave that aside, says Lubavitcher Rebbe, he thinks it's a mistake. Says normal suffering could theoretically be a punishment. However, he says, take a look at source number three. When it comes to what we experienced in the Holocaust, Lo yicholal yod b'tor onesh al avonot. The Holocaust was not a punishment. It's impossible to say such a thing. Now, I am telling you that there are yeshivas and seminaries that if I would just say this, they would think I'm the kofar. But says Lubavitcher Rebbe, it's inconceivable to say that the Holocaust was a punishment. Afilo hasatan atzmo. Lo yuchal limso cheshban avonot b'dor hu shebo kedei lehatzdik chas v'shalom onesh chamor kazeh. Even the Satan himself could not have found enough sins if he was prosecuting us to legitimize what we had to suffer, we had to experience during the Holocaust. Ein lo shum hesber biur. Says there is no explanation. Better to be silent than to make up ridiculous, cruel, and problematic explanations. We don't know al HaShoah. Rather, kach Allah b'machshava. Obviously God wanted it. He allowed it. But why? We have no idea. But vadai, lo hesber de onish alavonos. But one thing I will tell you for sure, said Lubavitcher Rebbe, it was not a punishment. It's inconceivable. Because there is no sin that could have been bad enough to deserve such a punishment. So the first thing, now that I've gotten you all in a good mood, right? The first point of the shiur is, I think there is, if a person wants to avoid the topic completely, I understand. But if we're going to have a shiur on the topic, if we're going to talk about it, we're going to think about it, the first thing is you have to be honest. And the instinct, which again may come from a frum place, that we can contextualize this and say, well, it's just part of Jewish history and we've had other bad things. Maybe it was a little bit worse, quantitatively, numbers-wise. It's a mistake. It's either you're being dishonest or you're just ignorant. And I can think of people who are one or both. But if you know the facts and you're honest, this is beyond anything. Beyond anything. And therefore, to just use normal categories is going to be insufficient and maybe even offensive. Okay? That's one point I think we have to be honest about. When we think about it and when we mourn what happened, what was lost, we have to know what was lost and how bad it was, or else we can't properly appreciate it. In addition to the overall cruelty, there was another thing which made the Holocaust unique. And this is maybe even more controversial and more sensitive to speak about. And that is the fact that through all sorts of reasons and mechanisms, when the Nazis, you know, in various countries, invoked in their plan, there was almost no organized resistance. And this is the famous, I guess nowadays you'd call it a meme, of like sheep to the slaughter. And this came in a context where already from before the 1940s, way before, there was, you know, a whole tumult in the Jewish community with secular Zionism and what was known as the New Jew. And that mindset that, you know, the Jews of Europe for hundreds of years have been weak. I'm saying Jews themselves felt this way, secular Jews. And therefore we're going to become this new Jew and Zionist and take our identity into our destiny into our own hands. Then all of a sudden when the Holocaust took place, it's not at all a surprise. A certain segment of the Jewish community looked at this and said, you see? Right? Secular Jews, secular Israelis, you know, embarrassed. It's cruel to say. I mean, it's painful to hear, but it's true. Embarrassed by the Jews of Europe. If you've ever been to Warsaw, you've ever been to the famous Holocaust Memorial there, as known as the Rappaport Memorial, it's this huge, huge gray stone memorial, which is, you know, part of any normal tour when you go there. You will see exactly that phenomenon. I've gone to Europe twice on these, you know, as a rabbi, as a tour, you know, as a madrich, once with the seminary students, once with yeshiva students. And you always go to Warsaw, of course, and you always go to the Rappaport Memorial. And the first time I went, I think it was the first, maybe it was the second time I went. One of the two times, even though there was a historian tour guide there with the group, and I was just the rabbi of the group, but I couldn't help but talk up. Because I found the Rappaport Memorial offensive. If you've seen it, and if not, you can go home and Google it. You can find pictures of it on the internet. There's two sides to it. On one of the sides, you see the Jews of Europe being led away. I can't remember who the sculptor was, the one who made the memorial. But it's obvious, plain as day, the people there look meek, look weak. He's clearly passing judgment on them. On the other side, you see the fighters of the Warsaw Ghetto, and they look strong and proud. And if you know any bit of the context, it's obvious what's happening there. He's not just celebrating the fighters of the Warsaw Ghetto, something that we could do, which we'll get to in a second, but he's doing it on the back of criticizing everybody else, that they went like sheep to the slaughter, which again, I don't know how popular or how common it was, but there's no question that it was, and maybe even to some circles still remains, a little bit of a canard of non-religious and certainly non-Eastern European Jewry towards so many of the millions of the Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. That is one of the main, not the only, but one of the main reasons that Yom HaShoah is so controversial. Vos Epis this week was Yom HaShoah. Of all the days of the year, why'd they pick that day? Because that's the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And it was clear that the Israeli government, when they established Yom HaShoah, were doing it in a way to say, you see, when we think about everything that happened in Europe, that's what we want to be associated with. Strong Jews, new Jews, the ones who fought back. Not like those religious Eastern European Jews who just went like sheep to the slaughter. So this is a very, very sensitive issue because, not surprisingly, given that attack, which I think is totally unfair and frankly cruel, the religious community and certainly the Haredi community has reacted, as typically, to go to the opposite extreme. And to, you know, deny the accusation outright, and what are you talking about? And it's so they feel so defensive, that, in my opinion, has clearly informed why they're so not supportive of actually fighting back. Because to fight back now would be somehow an acknowledgement of an indictment of the fact that they didn't fight back in Europe. Of course, at least I shouldn't say of course, that's not fair. In my opinion, I wouldn't say they're equally wrong, but they're both wrong. And I personally am much more identified with the next two sources, who are unimpeachably Gedolei Torah. The first, source number four, is from Yecheskel Sarna. Anyone know the name of Yecheskel Sarna? Yecheskel Sarna, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chevron Yeshiva. Right? At least for the last few generations, considered either the number one or number two Haredi Yeshiva in the world. Right? Ponovich of Chevron, when I was growing up, these were considered Lahavdil, the Harvard and Yale. If you were an Israeli Haredi, this is where you wanted to go. I mean, I'm not talking about America. No one can learn. If you ask the Israelis, no one in America knows how to learn. There's nothing in America that could compare. I don't know what they think about Lakewood now. And the mirror is just like for kids who couldn't get into the other two places. This is the way, again, if you know anything about the Haredi culture, again, Brisk is small, and it's weird for Americans, but Chevron, wow. I mean, and if you know anyone's list of the last 100, the biggest Rabbanim of the last, biggest, maybe 100 Rabbanim of the last few decades, a very high number of them were Chevron learners. It is a top yeshiva. It is. And Cheskel Sarna was the Rosh Yeshiva. Chevron was what was Slobodka, the famous Slobodka yeshiva of Europe. So when they transplanted to Israel, they became the Chevron yeshiva. Why did they pick the name Chevron? Because they originally transplanted to the city of Chevron. Then, of course, came the famous massacre and pogrom in 1929. They had to leave Chevron and they went to Yerushalayim. But as a memorial to those who were killed in Chevron, they kept the name of the, they kept, still called Yeshivat Chevron, even though it's in Yerushalayim. So in 1944, in December, when word finally got to the Jews of Yerushalayim, right? They didn't exactly have WhatsApp groups and internet and I-24, you know, whatever back then, right? They finally realized how bad it had been in Europe. There was a big asifa, a big gathering in the Chevron Yeshiva. And the Rosh Yeshiva, I don't know who else spoke, but the Rosh Yeshiva spoke. And I stumbled, I don't think this is that well known at all, this speech. I stumbled across it, I can't even remember how, but I was still living in Baltimore when I found this. And there's an academic, I think he's originally Israeli, and I don't know where he is now, but at the time he actually was in Washington. He was a professor at GW, University in Washington, D.C. And he is, I don't know if he might have been religious, he might be religious, but he was a scholar of the Holocaust, specifically a scholar of the Orthodox response to the Holocaust. And he translated in a book, which I was so impressed by, I actually bought the book. And in that book, there's a whole chapter, he translated this speech. Nowadays it still would be weird to do this, but in those days it was really weird. I was able to do some very rudimentary, you know, Google searches. I don't even know if they had Google. I can't remember what I was using then. Anyway, I went to the university website, to the faculty website. I got his email. I cold emailed him as a, you know, weirdo stalker, and I told him who I was. And I said to him, I'd love to get a copy of the original. And he was so nice, he sent it to me. But I can't. Ever since we made Aliyah, I can't find it. It's probably in one of those boxes that my wife's rolling her eyes that I haven't unpacked yet. It's only been 14 years. I got plenty of time. I don't remember. Greenberg maybe was the professor? I have it. I know I have it at home. I have it at home. But anyway, so somewhere I have the actual Hebrew. It really exists. Obviously, the speech wasn't given in English. But this is the English translation of that speech. It's a long speech. It's an incredible, incredible speech. But here you have, and again, it's important that I spent the last few minutes telling you who this is. Rabbi Cheskel Sarna, he's not a Bnei Akiva Madrich. He's not a general in the army. He's certainly not a secularist. Says Rabbi Cheskel Sarna, source number four, he's already aware, already in 1944, that we were thought of as, right, like sheep being led to the slaughter. And obviously that's a criticism of European Jewry. Says Rabbi Cheskel Sarna, he doesn't deny it. Has the world ever seen sheep brought to such a terrible slaughter? Was there ever another example of such cruel, I apologize for the typo, slaughtering? Woe is to us for our disaster. And now he says, during the destruction of the temple, the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, our nation was destroyed. We were many millions, and then afterwards, only tens of thousands were left, something I often try to stress on Tisha B'Av. It wasn't just a building that got destroyed on Tisha B'Av. Millions of Jews were killed. By the Babylonians, by the Romans. It was no picnic. It was no picnic. But there were battles during the Churban. We fought back during the Churban. There was heroism. also from our side, and tens of thousands of the enemy also died. This is unlike the slaughtering and killing now. Slaughter like slaughtering mosquitoes without the possibility of opposition. So says the Chevron Rosh Hashiva. And this is the difference between him, Lahavdil, and whoever made the Rappaport Memorial. It's not a criticism to criticize the European Jewry. I mean, it's so cruel, so ignorant. It's a terrible thing. But the facts are right. They did go like sheep to the slaughter. And we can acknowledge that that's terrible. That makes it worse, says Rabbi Cheskel Sarna. It's bad enough to be killed, but to not even be able to put up a fight, to walk quietly and politely to your own death, that adds to the Chil Hashem. Why do we have to deny that? To be upset by that, to be almost offended by that. The secular Jews are right. They're wrong in their judgment of the people. That's terrible. Of course, Rechaz Hassan would never agree to that. But should we deny what our own eyes can see, what our own brain can tell us? That you have two people, both of whom are killed, but one could fight back and one who just said, okay, where do you want me to stand as you cut my head off? It's obviously more demeaning to not fight back. There's a certain mile, there's a certain pride, a certain virtue, even if you're fighting the losing fight, but to fight. We don't just sit there saying Tehillim, waiting to get walked away. Said Rabbi Cheskel Sarna. Why would we deny that? It's so obvious. Again, the reason that so many in the Torah community deny it is just defensiveness, it's just reflexive. Because the secularists attacked us this way, but it's wrong. And beyond you, it doesn't really pass the muster for most thinking people, if they think about it. This is much more compelling. Why can't we acknowledge that? A foil or a companion to that is source number five. We go back to Rav Yaakov Weinberg, again, from the Warsaw Ghetto. As some of you may know, the Warsaw Ghetto uprising was very controversial. Now, first of all, in the moment, and who among us could possibly know what we would have done if we were there? So confusing. We should fight, we shouldn't fight. Should we, you know, try to just hide? Should we just hopefully, you know, have patience and the Allies are coming and the war is getting better and the Nazis are starting to lose and should we fight back? There's no way we can win. Very complex. You would need to be a Navi to really know what to do in the time. And obviously most of the people who were actually leading the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising were not religious. But there were religious Jews, there were Rabbanim who were alive at the time. And they did consult. So for example, maybe the greatest Hasidic Rav who was still alive then was Rav Menachem Zemba, who was a Ger Hasid. We have, you know, contemporaneous reports from religious Jews who were in the ghetto at the time that they asked Rav Menachem Zemba and he supported the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. That's in the book that I borrowed from you a few years ago, The Warsaw Ghetto Diaries by Menachem Zeidman. But here we have something which I think is less well known, which is from Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sridi Yesh. And he writes with such pride, from a religious Torah perspective, about the people who fought in the ghetto uprising. He talks about how, you know, these were such dark... We already saw what he said a few minutes ago in source number two, about how horrible the Warsaw Ghetto was. He says, but it was only one of the only things that was a ray of sun, a ray of light, in all those horrible years of darkness in the ghetto, was the gvura of those who fought back. Sof tsof, nimsu goalim l'chvod ha'am habazui v'hashasui. Right? To just be there while they're starving you, while they're torturing you, and not even... and just go along, it's humiliating. It's demeaning. It's not humiliating to fight back. If Goliath beats you, that's not humiliating. It may stink, but it's not humiliating. To just sit there and take it is humiliating. And finally, he said, so finally, we had people who were willing to fight back. And he talked about young people who did what they could. Ube'ezor sherut kocham heshivu gmul tzodek l'maneim hachzarim. Right, they gave it back a little bit to this cruel enemy, the kachaya hamered shall get to havarshai, ledaf mazhir b'tkufat hachashecha hahi, a little ray of light in this very, very dark period. And then he says here at the end, yes, of course they lost. And he mentions, of course, how the people who were the mordim were Jews of all types, Bundists, Zionists, Agudists, Mizrachnikim. They were all together, mostly not religious, but certainly some religious. And they did what they could, even though they knew that they were going to lose. But it didn't matter. They were going to fight back. They were going to go down fighting. But misasam, they died a hero's death, mot giborim. And in so doing, kidshu shem ha'am v'yisrael mechulal. It was a kiddush Hashem that they fought back. So this is obviously a perfect companion to Rabbi Cheskel Sarner's observation that the chil Hashem of the Holocaust was worse because, and again, I stressed for maybe the third or the fourth time, I have no doubt, I'm certainly not, but I have no doubt that Rabbi Cheskel Sarner, when he said the chil Hashem was worse because they didn't fight back, he wasn't criticizing them. Chas v'shalom, it shouldn't be confused with some secularist perspective, some anti-religious perspective, the Rappaport Memorial, which I think is terrible. Just cruel, simplistic. In 99% of the cases, what did you want them to do? Of course they couldn't fight back. But even if we're not judging them, chas v'shalom, but if we're taking a step back and looking at it and trying to wrap our head around how terrible it was worse because they couldn't fight back. That is worse. That's more demeaning. And that's why if you could find Po Vasham, Jews who did fight back, we can celebrate that and say that was a Kiddush Hashem. But those were the exceptions, rare, rare exceptions. So when we're processing in our mind what happened in the Holocaust and why that is such a challenge to our faith, it's not just, 6 million. That's a number. But it's more than that. It's also how it happened. And the how is not just the cruelty of the Nazis. It's the passivity, maybe by no one's fault, but the fact that we just, as he says, like mosquitoes or like sheep. Rav Cheskel Sarner uses that phrase. I'm not sure if he was aware that there already were anti-religious people using that as a criticism, but he's not embarrassed to use that phrase. We were like sheep to the slaughter, and that's terrible. It may not have been their fault, chas v'shalom, but it is objectively worse than at least being able to fight for your life, and having some pride. So this is obviously very, very difficult. Now, I want to add that with all of that said, the paradox, I think, is on some level, we still believe, and certainly my Rebbeim still believe, that even if the Holocaust was unique and unprecedented, which I certainly have made the case I think it is, we still have to somehow fit it into a larger pattern of Jewish history. At least in the sense that, if it wouldn't have been for the original, problems of Jewish history, depends on how far back you want to go. Originally, you could say is the Meraglim, or you could say the original being the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. But there couldn't have been a Holocaust if there hadn't been a Churban. Ultimately, everything goes back to that, which is why I, among many others, try to talk about the Holocaust every year on Tisha B'Av. I don't think that's contradicting anything I've said until now, but it's an important counterbalance. There's a well-known medrash in source number 6, which I often quote on Tisha B'Av. And I've heard this point made, I think, by Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Gifter, who else? Rav Asher Weiss, Lahavdu Mechaim Chaim. This medrash is very, very powerful. It talks about how there was a certain woman in the neighborhood of Rabban Gamliel whose son had died, unfortunately. And she was so inconsolable, she cried and she cried every night. And when Rabban Gamliel would hear her tears every night, crying over the loss of her child, he would start crying, and he would say, "Oh, it's so terrible that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed." So you read this medrash, at first glance you say, well, Rabban Gamliel was an impressive person, right? How empathetic, right? We all feel bad when somebody, Nebuch, has a tragedy. But how many of us are crying with the person night after night to the point that Rabban Gamliel's eyelashes fell out? He cried so much. So he's empathetic. He was a very holy person, very special person. But it's still a non sequitur. You could just say, I feel bad for this woman that she lost her child. But that's not what the Medrash says. It says every time he cried for her, he said, oh, it's so terrible the Beis HaMikdash. This wasn't when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. What is this child's death for whatever sickness or whatever? What have to do with the Beis HaMikdash? But you see from this, I'll use a phrase which I often quote on Tisha B'Av, the Yiddish expression I'm adopting from Rav Asher Weiss, Ali Yiddish Tzaris Zen an Ein Groisa Tzara. In the end, it's all one big Tzara, called the Churban. So, if we want to know, theologically, hashkafically, how are we processing all of this? So I think the first instinct has to be to learn enough, to be educated enough, both in Torah sources and just in facts, in history, the raw facts of history, to understand that the actual events, in terms of the scope, the fact that we couldn't fight back, unprecedented. And it is the greatest Chil Hashem in all of human history. To just say, oh, this was just another Crusades, another Spanish expulsion, another... You're doing injustice to everything to say that. It was much worse. Churban, the Chil Hashem was much worse. But at the same time, the complexity of it is that we also nevertheless still believe that the ultimate cause, yes, was the Churban. I think they said the name of the Chafetz Chaim. He says, when people would come to him and say, I don't have any money, and they want to daven for parnasa, my wife is sick, my child is sick, my husband is sick, they daven for health. He says, it's fine, you could do all those things. But then I realize, the real brachas that Shemoneh Esrei should have been kavana for, are for the Yerushalayim Ircha, and Goel Yisrael, and Masech HaZena. Because if we actually would have Mashiach, we'd have a gula, then all the other problems would be taken care of. That's the root problem. Now, balancing these two is complicated. What, you thought I was going to give you an easy shiur today? You saw the title, right? This is not an easy topic. And part of the challenge is balancing these two things. Yes, there is a pattern of Jewish history, and the Holocaust now is a part of that. But at the same time, it's an unprecedented part. And to try to somehow just force it into that box is an injustice. Now, I don't have time to read all of source 7 inside. As you turn over the page, you see how big it is. But I want to point out something which I think is incredibly important to stress. Again, not everybody, and we're not judging the people. I don't know what the numbers are, but obviously countless people lost their faith during the Holocaust. I have relatives. And my Bubby was one of three who survived from her big Hasidic family. Her and one sister remained religious, but the other sister was not. My Zaidi was one of two who survived. He was religious. His brother was not. They were all Hasidim before the war. But that, some of them could. So no one's judging anybody who did lose their faith. But it is important to acknowledge how many millions of survivors, I mean, people who died too, died with Shema Yisrael on their lips, but even survivors who retained their faith. And something which I find always amazing, and I try to stress on Tisha B'Av as often as I can, in other contexts, to me, one of the most remarkable things were the shilas that were being asked during the Holocaust. Not only because if you like study Torah and you're intellectual, they're interesting and they're complex. That's all true. But the very fact that people in the most dire and desperate of circumstances could even ask shilas and then actually listen is unbelievable. I have a list, there are hundreds, I'm sure maybe even thousands of such examples. I just gave you one which may be the most powerful. And if I would have known how much time I wouldn't have, I don't know if I would have spent so much time last night typing this all up. But okay, we won't read it all inside. But this is from a sefer called Shut Mekadshei Hashem. Already the title gets your attention. It was written by a Rav who was a Holocaust survivor named Rav Meisels, who went to Chicago. Famous Chicago Rav was a Holocaust survivor. And he wrote all sorts of tshuvas. But in the beginning, this is from the introduction to his work. He talks about some of his experiences in the Holocaust. He makes the point I just made about the shilas he was getting and how incredible that it was. But he talks specifically, and again, he talks about how, he says, for generations, people need to know these stories because they're so inspiring. He says the one thing he really wants to share with us, one thing he'll never forget, is a particular story. And he talks about how when he was in Auschwitz, I can't remember if he writes the year, but I don't remember the year. If it's the year, I didn't see it. On Rosh Hashanah, the days leading up to Rosh Hashanah in Auschwitz, one of the years he was there, how it was a certain selection of 1,400 boys. And they were separated, and everyone knew that it was just a matter of days, but at some point, these boys were all going to get killed. And there were parents in Auschwitz at the time who were desperate to see if they could somehow rescue their children before those children were killed. The problem was that the kapos, who were not Nazis, but sometimes even worse than the Nazis, who were in charge of guarding them, how are you going to get them to release your child? So you say, well, you could bribe them. So not everyone had any money to bribe them. But even those who did, the problem was the Germans were German. They were Yekis. As we know, they had very precise records. They knew exactly how many people were going to be killed. And they told the kapos that they're going to count again when they kill them. And if there's anybody missing, it's going to be them who's going to get killed. So even if you were, and the parents were aware of this, even if you could somehow bribe a capo to let your son die, the capo would then just grab somebody else to take his place. So a father comes to Rav Meisel's and asks him, he says, I have some money, I can ransom my child. But if I do that, the kappa will take somebody else. Am I allowed? Right? You mean, again, I get people having trouble breathing now, I could see it. That's what they were going through. So I don't know what I would have done on my own, but to ask a shaila, some people would just desperately want to do it. But to say no, and just to make matters worse, this was this man's only child. And he writes about how this person asked him the question. He writes, look, if you look in the middle where I just write in, just to give you a sense of even years later, Rav Meisel, how affected he was by this. L'olam lo eshkach uvda no ra'a achas, asher einai ra'u, v'oznai shamu, oz b'shas inyan hanal. He says, I will never forget what my own eyes saw, what my own ears heard. And he tells you this particular story. Hamisamel es kedushas b'nei Yisrael. Right, this one story is emblematic of the holiness of the Jewish people and how dedicated they were to following the Torah, even in the most difficult of times and period. And again, now the next bit of it, he tells you the whole story, and then he talks about how his response to the person. I don't know if I can find it inside here, but somewhere in here I included. He wrote back to the his response at the time. Right, right. I know we're all feeling bad for the father. I'm feeling bad for the rabbi. Could you imagine being the rabbi on the other end of that? How do you answer such a shaila? So Rav Meisel, he writes, he goes, I didn't. He says, I said, a shaila like this, to answer such a question, I would need all my svarim and other rabbinic colleagues to discuss this with, like a Sanhedrin. He goes, I got no rabbis in Auschwitz and I got no books. How am I supposed to give you an answer? He goes, I'm not telling you it's usher, but I can't tell you it's mutter. Do what you want. And he writes it, again, I can't even read it all in Yiddish, but I typed it for those who know how to read Yiddish. He writes how he wouldn't let him go, the father. I need an answer. I need an answer. And when Rav Meisel wouldn't give him an answer, he says, I understand. He says, if you can't tell me that it's mutter, it must be that it's usser. And I won't do it. I won't do it, he says. Time and time again, he tried. Eventually, he just accepts it because Rav Meisel won't give him an answer. And Rav Meisel gets upset. Says, no, I didn't say that. I didn't say you can't do it. If you don't do it, don't. It's not my responsibility. I'm not telling you you can't. And the father says, no, but if you're not telling me I can, then it must be that I can't. No, I didn't say that. And finally, this is the most incredible part. At the end, he writes, the last three lines, Haya kol hayom yomo de Rosh Hashanah. So this was all happening on Rosh Hashanah. And this man, he says, Rabbi Meisel says, I saw afterwards. He was walking around the whole day, holech umadabar lathwa, speaking to himself, talking to himself, Besimcha, with great joy, shezochel lahakriv es beno yechida laKadosh Baruch Hu. He was filled with a certain amount of joy that he could sacrifice his own son to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ki av sheyesh yicholet biyado leftoso, even though he could have ransomed him and saved him, he didn't do it. Machmas sheroa shehatora lo hitira lo lasos kazos. Because he felt, based on Rabbi Zell's not answering him, it must be that it's usher. It could be that it is. It's not a simple question. To save your son at the expense of somebody else. And he said, this man felt about himself that what he was doing, Choshuv l'fnei Hashem Yisbarach, ka'akedas Yitzchak Avinu. It was his own personal akeda, which of course we read about every year on Rosh Hashanah. So we just read about a story that happened long ago, and Yitzchak survives. And he feels now, I am doing even more than Yitzchak. I mean, even more than Avram, excuse me. I am sacrificing my son, Al Kiddush Hashem. So this is Echad Mina Elif, although this might be the most powerful one, but I have 100 others of these incredible, incredible. And the answer is not important, but the Shaila. And the fact that they were willing to ask the Shailas to accept the answers, the non-answers. Right? Gvura is not just, muscle, and it's not just the Warsaw Ghetto. Again, I'm not taking anything away from the Warsaw Ghetto, as I was saying a few minutes ago. But can there be any greater gvura than this? Right? There's no contradiction. Again, we live in such a simplistic and a false world in which we feel we have to choose. Either you believe in spiritual gvura or you believe in physical gvura. I have no idea how we got to such a pathetic place as a community. They're obviously both true. Why do we have to pick? They're both true. There's such a thing as spiritual gvura, and there's such a thing as physical gvura. It's incredible. They're both incredible. We should admire and be inspired by both. We should aspire to both. And this is just one, but incredible example of spiritual gvura. One of the things which I think is very, very powerful, and there's enough that I could have given an entire hour here on this. Maybe I even did a few years ago. One of the things which is another point I want to get to, even though we're only going to do it very abbreviatedly, which I think is an important statement of hashkafa, but also was a form of nechama, was the notion of imo anochi b'tzara. Take a look at source number 8. Again, there are many, many midrashim I could have given you that are actually very powerful. This is not a powerful image or metaphor, but this is when Hashem speaks to Moshe and says, you know, go to Egypt and let my people go. Tell Paro, how does Hashem speak to Moshe? Through a bush, a burning bush. But it wasn't any kind of bush, it was a thorn bush. Hard, dry, with, you know, sharp, painful. So Rashi famously says from the Medrash, why did Hashem pick that? Hashem couldn't have picked a nice lilac, some nice soft petals, some tulips. Why such a dry, hard, sharp thorn bush? Says Rashi, as if to communicate vicariously to Moshe, anoch imo anochi b'tzara. It's as if God was saying, it's not just the Jews who are in pain in Egypt, I'm also suffering, I'm also feeling like I'm in this thorn bush, you know, getting scratched and poked and prodded, and I'm also suffering. This idea, which again, there's many, many midrashim to describe this, again, very complex and powerful idea theologically, what does that mean? That somehow, whatever this means exactly on a God, on a divine level, that God suffers along with us. Again, on a human level, we can understand it. God forbid, Rahman al-Aslan, anyone whose children, whose child is ever suffering, right? The parent is suffering right along with the child, if not more so. So, Avinu Shebashamayim, when we suffer, he's suffering right there along with us. And this is clearly something which comes up in many, many midrashim. So why is that important? And how does that relate to the Holocaust? So I will share with you two stories. One on the source sheet, one that's not. The one that's not on the source sheet, Rabbi Lau, the Rabbi Lau, not the chief rabbi, the father of the chief rabbi, the former chief rabbi, who was a Holocaust survivor, very famously, the youngest survivor of the Holocaust, who then went on to become the chief rabbi, an incredible story. So in his memoirs, he survived with a brother, Naftali, who eventually became a big diplomat for Israel, Tel Aviv. So he says that when they first were in Yerushalayim shortly after the Holocaust, his brother, who was older than him, was somehow, their father had been a well-known Hasidic Rav in Europe. I think it was a Hasidic family, I think. Anyway, somehow they were in the basis of the Meir Sharim area neighborhood, the Gula neighborhood. He said there was one night, in the middle of the night, like 1 a.m, knock at the door. It was the Beis Yisrael. It wasn't known as Beis Yisrael then, but the son of the Ger Rebbe. The Ger Rebbe then was the Imre Emes. When he died in 1948, his next son took over, became known as the Beis Yisrael, who was the fourth Rebbe of Ger. But he wasn't yet the Rebbe yet. I think his father was still alive. But he was one who went on to become the Ger Rebbe, a super intense person, as this story is an example of. And he says that his brother told him that he obviously gets a knock on the door from the Ger Rebbe's son. He says, yeah, let's take a walk. He says, they paced for over an hour in Yerushalayim without talking. And after an hour, this Ger Rebbe says, looks at him in the eyes, says, tell me the truth. Were you in the camps? He said, yes. Tell me the truth. Did you see the crematoria? He says, yes. Tell me the truth. You saw the smoke coming up, bellowing up from the crematoria? He says, yes. Now tell me, did you see? Was Hashem there? Did you see him in the smoke? And there's incredible need. Imo Anochi Batzara, Hashem was there with us. So keep that story in mind. Source number 9. A story from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Lichtenstein lived for many, many years in Yerushalayim after they made Aliyah. And they were friendly. They had a neighbor whose name was Leib Rachman. He was a Holocaust survivor. And this is the punchline I wanted to give you, but I didn't give you the whole story. Anyway, he tells a story about how this Holocaust survivor was having a Friday night dinner with somebody, and there was some pseudo-intellectual, he calls him, who's at the Friday night dinner. Can you imagine doing this with a Holocaust survivor at the table? Who's making all these comments, you know, where was God in the Holocaust, and you see there's no God, and religion is so silly, etc. So this Holocaust survivor, at some point after dinner, runs over to Rav Lichtenstein. Obviously, he was much younger than him, but was already, you know, he was Rav Lichtenstein. And he tells him the story. And he tells him that when this person was ridiculing him, talking about, you know, where was God in the Holocaust, so the man with great, you know, power and emotion in Yiddish said to him, he was with us. And Rav Lichtenstein adds, and this is a little part of the story I gave you here, that how obvious it was as he told the story, how much comfort that gave this man. There's a certain nechama that we need to have. Again, not easy, but we have to know that when we go through this, we didn't go through it alone. Do we understand why? Of course, who could possibly begin to understand why? As Rav Lubavitcher Rebbe said, inconceivable. We can't understand one tzara. We can't understand the death of one person, one child. How can we possibly understand the death of a million children, of 6 million? It's inconceivable. We can understand why. But we should be aware that we were not alone. Imo Anochi Betzara. And this gives us great, great comfort. And last but not least, both in terms of thinking about what happened, but also what happened after the fact, so we should also take comfort, not only in knowing that we were never alone, but of course the greatest comfort is the Jewish history. That the resilience of the Jewish people. The fact that any other nation would have been destroyed by something far less. And not only were we not destroyed, yes, we were knocked down, but we don't stay down. We got right back up. There's a very, very famous passage, we won't read it now, in source number 10, way before the Holocaust, hundreds of years before, from Yaakov Emden, who says when he looks at Jewish history, and to use a different metaphor of a sheep, and he sees that the Jewish people, as Chazal say, are like one little sheep surrounded by 70 wolves. He says, when I look at Jewish history, from this pogrom to that pogrom, this massacre to that massacre, crusades, expulsions, etc., etc., even before the Holocaust, Jewish history is littered with horrible things. And yet, from generation to generation, country to country, we survive. He says, the Jewish history and our survival is a greater miracle even than Kriyas Yamsuf. We think, ooh, we split the sea, that's a miracle. He says, that's nothing compared to the fact that we're just here. This is the greatest miracle. How could you possibly explain the existence of the Jewish people, he says. And he was describing that miracle when we were still in Golos. So let's end with source number 11. This is a letter that Rav Asher Weiss wrote just a few years ago. Somebody in the Haredi community, maybe Hasidish, wrote to Rav Asher Weiss, and maybe he was a principal or he was the head of an educational network, and he asked Rav Asher Weiss, Das Torah, what should be our goals as educators, as schools, as machanchim, when we're teaching about the Holocaust? How should we teach about the Holocaust to children? So Rav Asher Weiss wrote him back a letter, and he says there's three things you should emphasize. We don't have time for the first two. But the third one, he says, and this is the third Rav Asher Weiss says, but the third thing is the most important, he says. The Iker, he says, Yesh lahadgish et hatkuma hamufla'a shezachinu la b'ikvos hashoah ulachara. The greatest thing you need to emphasize was the resilience and the rebirth of the Jewish people after the Holocaust. T'chiyas ha'am v'hayahadut hayta l'nes galui. The resiliency of the Jewish people after the Holocaust, the fact that we rebuilt, is an open miracle. Am Yisrael shav la'artzeinu hakadosha livnot ulhibanot ba. And he doesn't just speak about it, you know, what happened in Golders Green and in Melbourne and in Borough Park. Says Rav Asher Weiss, the fact that we came back to the land of Israel, the fact that we rebuilt our homeland, is the greatest miracle. Kal Yisrael hitna'ar me'afar kumi, right? We get up from the dust. We're like a phoenix, rising from the ashes, from the ghettos, right? We went from being, you know, the dust and the ashes of the ghettos and the crematoria to rebuild the Jewish people. This has to be the main emphasis. He's talking about teaching children, but I would say it's just as important for adults. Yes, says Rav Asher Weiss. Against maybe other people might not agree. He says, we have to teach this. And we can't sugarcoat it. We can't pretend it wasn't so bad and other things. No, we have to talk about it the way it really was. But not just for the purpose of making them have questions and question their faith. On the contrary, l'chazek their amuna. They should realize et chazdei hashamayim ve'es nes tkumat klal Yisrael, the rebirth, the revivification of the Jewish people, and how we're even stronger now than we were before. Or as I've heard him say in other contexts, the Jewish people in our generation are not witnesses to the miracle, we are the miracle. Think about it. We are not witnesses to the miracle, we are the miracle. So yes, it was horrible. And at least once a year, if not more, at least once a year we need to think about it, how bad it was. But at the same time, our predominant feeling, I think it's both emotionally healthier and religiously healthier, is to be filled with awe and gratitude for what has happened since then. And I think personally, you know, this speaks to me so much in light of obviously the last 6 months. As terrible as it's been, you know, we shouldn't, you know, this is, again, we are part of Jewish history, and Jewish history has these ups and downs. We thought we were done with this stuff. But of course, there's one difference, which Rav Chaskel Sarner would have appreciated, we now know. Now we fight back. Right? It doesn't take away the pain of what's happened. But we are in a position, and we should be grateful for that as well. So anyway, I thought I'd just give you a light cheer today. So I appreciate that, and you know, you should have a good day. Anyway, in all seriousness, I think these are important things every now and then to talk about. And yashar koach to everybody.
Yashar koach to you. It was a beautiful shiur.
Thank you.
I sat at Rav Chaskel Sarner's table every Shabbos.
Wow, you knew him.